What's up, guys?
Primarily,
hey,
hey.
It was primarily because the guy wouldn't accommodate his schedule.
Mm.
And I'm like, that's kind of part of the lifestyle. You know, the guy, he says, I don't want to do weekends. And I respect the fact that, you know, look, you don't want to do weekends. I get it.
Hello, guys.
Hey.
Hello.
Hello,
Phil Kaplan.
How is everybody?
Good.
Excellent.
Good. Still saying good?
Yep. Good.
Hmm.
I'm better than I was yesterday.
Okay, excellent. That's what I'm looking for. So if you saw my email, in a few minutes I'm going to tell you all about a seminar that I can't tell you about.
Cool.
Seriously, I'm going to tell you about a seminar I honestly cannot tell you about. But my hope is that within the framework of my sworn confidentiality, I'll be able to tell you a little about the experience, and then I'll tell you why I'm telling you about the seminar I can't tell you about. Would you guys say you learn from people?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't mean like just teachers in school, but just people, very often people who you don't expect can teach you anything, right? We have these sort of life lessons that we never expected.
Yep.
How else do we learn?
Kids at class, right?
Oh, absolutely. How else do we learn other than from people and from kids?
Through our own experience.
Yeah. Well, and what about intentionally? Like if you go, I'm in the mood to learn something, what would you do?
YouTube.
Okay, so you would watch something or?
Or read.
Listen
to something or read something.
Read something.
So, you know, we understand some are more visual, some are more auditory, some are more kinesthetic. And I'm really practiced at kind of moving through all three zones. But it's the visual part of learning for me that most cements something. In other words, I'll observe and I'll listen and I'll feel. But when something really gets cemented for me, when I develop certainty, it's almost always from a visual. So you've heard it said, I'll believe it when I see it. That's very true for me, but it's a little more complex because the reality is I'll believe it when I see it, provided that I have a foundational belief that already exists. So it's not enough for me to just see something. I need a foundational belief upon which a vision can be placed in order for me to accept it. So has anybody seen The Regurgitator on America's Got Talent? I think I brought him up once before.
Mm-hmm.
Has anybody seen him?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so he eats objects that there's no way in the world anybody could eat. And they go into his belly, according to him. And he does this like, right in front of the camera. He swallows a light bulb. Like, he takes a regular-sized light bulb, he puts it in his mouth, he makes this weird sound, and you see the light bulb go into his mouth, and he goes, it's in my belly. And then he eats some other stuff, like a live fish, and then he brings them up. And he'll even ask the audience, like, what order they want the things to come up in. It's an amazing act. I love watching him. The Regurgitator.
Oh, thank you.
No, thank you.
You know, it is one of those acts where you go, oh, man, this is gross. I can't watch. But then you watch, and then you can't believe it. So my mind knows he doesn't really eat a light bulb. I know he doesn't. And then he does this thing where he eats a coin, like he'll have very specific coins, like he'll have people put letters on the coins. So if he's spelling the word Tony, T-O-N-Y. See, Tony? I've been practicing. Before the call, I actually looked it up and I practiced it, how to spell it, T-O-N-Y. So he'll say, okay, which coin do you want me to swallow first? And people go, the O, and he'll swallow the O. Now it's the N, and then he'll ask what order to bring them up in. But he does this little thing when he swallows the second coin, you hear the clink as if like they're hitting, you know, inside his stomach. Now, I know there's no way we're going to hear that clink. They're not going to clink because there's peristalsis. There's a stomach lining. There's stomach acids. So I know it's a trick. I know it's a trick. The other thing is he swallowed Heidi Klum's ring, her diamond ring, and then he did what he does. He regurgitated it, and she's giving it back to her, and she's kind of looking grossed out. He goes, no, don't worry. It's not wet. Things come up dry. Now, I know that if I just put something in my mouth, if I take it out, it's going to be wet. Okay, so I have all this evidence to believe that he's not really eating them, yet I could see it. So I could see it, but not believe it. I know it's an illusion. Now, if I went to some lecture and I heard a doctor speak about a way for non-food objects to travel through the digestive tract without being touched by bodily fluids, I'd kind of raise my eyebrow. Oh, wait a minute. And if I re-explored anatomy to identify how this could actually work, I'd go, maybe. And if the regurgitator then allowed me to watch him close up and conduct an X-ray or an MRI to show me the object in his gut, I'd have a new belief. Now, all of that, of course, is not realistic, but that's the way I build my beliefs. So while I usually need to see something to believe it, I need to have an established foundation upon which the vision sits. Now, we're not all visual in that order. We don't all need to see it to believe it, but we do all need a foundation to set a new belief upon. And in more cases than not, if you look at all the beliefs that you hold, that foundation exists beneath the conscious level. So I spoke at, and then I attended a seminar that was so incredible, it was insane. Really, I mean, the whole thing was insane. And I went back and forth in my head between the world needs to know this and nobody should ever know this. And it was really completely crazy, and I'm telling you, I can't tell you about it. I was invited to present for 15 minutes. I was invited by a friend who's very accomplished in the field of human behavior, somebody who's really helped me a great deal in understanding some things. And she wanted me to speak in front of this group, and she asked if I would describe how, using access to the various centers of the brain, like the PFC and the nucleus accumbens, I was able to foster such a high level of adherence in an 8-week exercise program. So, of course, I said, yes, of course, I would love to speak to that. Only 15 minutes? She said, yes. So this is not an exercise group, but they're going to be fascinated by the fact that you were able to create compliance, understanding psychology.
I've got Jack on the phone from Eastern.
Whoever's talking or has talking in the background, if you could mute, that'd be good.
I found them.
Who is that? Is that Jason or Tony?
It's not me. I think it's Jason.
So she asked me to speak in front of this group. I didn't know who the group were. I just knew they were not exercise people, and it was in Pittsburgh, and I've been spending a good amount of time in Pittsburgh. So really, she wanted me to talk about how to create human connection at a subconscious level. So I didn't know what to expect, but I didn't really think much about it. The seminar was held at the Mellon Center in Pittsburgh, not like watermelons and cantaloupes, but Mellon, M-E-L-L-O-N, which is a big financial center in Pittsburgh. It's a very tall building, and it's a very nice building. And we went up to whatever floor it was on, and before we entered the room, a security guard stood looking very menacing at a table, and at the table was a woman who smiled, but I think she was a machine. I don't think she was real, because she was the closest I've ever seen to perfect. And I don't mean perfect in a beautiful, feminine kind of way. I just mean her hair was perfect, her suit was perfect, her tonality, her presence. I mean, she was like the queen of human resources. She was so like a terminator of human resources. So you're getting the idea. She was like an android, like somebody created her. And she was just someone who seemed really important. You just felt, oh, she's important, perfectly important, kind of flawless. So at the table in this reception area, a very nice reception area, the woman greeted you, and she had you sign a letter of confidentiality. So that's where it started. You have to sign something saying you're not going to tell anybody about what you learned. And then in little clusters of people, she explained why it's important that what we learn in this room is used only for the purpose of improving service to clients. And then after that, we had to sign a release. And the release said that we would hold the companies putting on this event harmless for anything that might come from using what we learned. So I'm thinking, what are we going to learn? I mean, I'm just teaching them about how people stick to my exercise program. What are we going to learn in here? And then finally, there was a third document we had to sign, a release saying that we are not in any way receiving license to use the techniques or strategies we may learn. So that's why I say I can't tell you about the seminar. I don't want this woman to bring people after me. So after everybody completed the paperwork, because we were all in a reception area, we were ushered as a group into a conference room that held about 25 people, maybe a little more, and it was full. These were marketing people in the world of finance. And I knew when I saw the audience that this was a special gathering, not like a weekly event that takes place. So I got up, I did my talk. They were people, you know, and they took notes. And before I knew it, my 15 minutes was up. I didn't have a PowerPoint, so I really kind of hoped for more dialogue, but they were just very serious, and they were note-taking, and they enjoyed it, and they clapped. And then I turned it over to the main speaker. The main speaker was a former advertising executive in New York, Madison Avenue, who now does private consulting for Wall Street firms. Okay, so I was there out of sheer luck. I mean, this was really a privilege. It wasn't that they were privileged to hear me. It was the reverse. I was really privileged to be there. So this speaker, an older gentleman, but clearly very seasoned and very smart, spoke about the results that the big companies don't want you to know about. Spoke about true secrets of Madison Avenue. Not little secrets, I mean big secrets. And here's the biggest secret, and I think I'm okay to share this with you. Pornography sells. Pornography sells. That's how he started his talk. What's that? Did somebody say something?
I said, I don't think that's a secret, though.
No, I don't think so either, but that's how he started his talk. So what are we going to learn here today? And there was a PowerPoint, but it hadn't come on screen yet. So what is this going to be about? This whole thing is a mystery to me. So it starts with pornography sells. So I'm thinking, okay, these guys run like these major pornographic websites and make zillions of dollars. Like, I didn't know. Pornography sells. I can't share anymore. That's it, guys. So pornography sells. See ya. No, I can't really share very much more because I know they were serious about protecting the information. But after I presented, two psychologists specializing in neurobehavior, that's what their business cards say. Neurobehavior would be the links between brain and action. So these two psychologists presented new findings on brain wiring. Now that's right, I love that stuff. So I'm fascinated. Nothing to do with pornography. Then a neuroscientist spoke about a paper that has turned the neuroscience field upside down by showing novel differences in conscious and subconscious activity. Okay, interesting. But then it got crazy. Then, as a group, they started to talk about subliminal advertising. Now, I knew a little about it. Anybody know anything about subliminal advertising? Anything at all? Like, is this a new term to you, or have you heard of it before?
I remember... Go ahead, sorry.
Go ahead, Tony.
That they used to do that. I don't know if they do. In movie theaters, that was one of the big studies I learned about in marketing, where they would do these really immediate, instantaneous flashes about, like, buy Coke or buy popcorn. And in these studies, they were able to increase the amount of popcorn and Coke that people bought.
That was in the 1950s. That's
yes,
when it started. And it didn't say buy popcorn. It said
Coke.
Enjoy popcorn, enjoy Coca-Cola. It's really significant. There's a big difference between buy popcorn and enjoy popcorn, enjoy Coca-Cola. Tasha, what were you going to say?
Basically the same thing. I thought it was that they were showing images of the product as well at some point, that they were trying to influence you to buy or the behavior that they wanted.
They were. And if you're familiar with old, like, 16-millimeter film, you know a frame flashes by so quickly your conscious, your eye doesn't catch it, but your subconscious mind does. So that's the premise. So although you're not consciously thinking, wow, I'd really like to enjoy popcorn and enjoy Coca-Cola, suddenly, because of this flash, you get the urge. And why do I say it's very different than saying buy popcorn? Anybody know? Because enjoy is an emotion. This is really important. For subliminal advertising to be effective, it has to activate emotion. So buy popcorn is a linear command. Enjoy popcorn, you start thinking about it. So it's not like you're hypnotized. It's not like a command tells you what to do. That would be different. It's like all of a sudden thoughts happen in your brain. And you're not aware that you started thinking this way until suddenly you go, I'm really craving some popcorn. I'd like to enjoy Coca-Cola. So Coca-Cola is one of the companies to most use subliminal advertising. And when I was exposed to some of their ads, I was really blown away. I mean, even expecting that they did some real tricky stuff, and even knowing that he started by saying pornography sells, I'm telling you, I was blown away. And again, I'm sort of promised not to share all the details. So I'm going to give you bits and pieces, and I think you'll get the gist of it. But it really was amazing. These really are secrets that I never even knew about. And I've been studying this stuff. And I was in advertising. I was on Madison Avenue. Guys, I'm going to do something I don't like to do. I'm going to ask you to hold on a second because my mom is calling and my dad is getting out of a rehab center today. And let me just see what's going on. So bear with me a second. Mom?
I'm on a call right now. Okay. Okay, great. Okay, thanks.
Sorry about that. Okay, so I can't be thinking about pornography when my mother calls, so I got totally thrown off track now. Pornography sells. I'm getting myself back into this. Enjoy popcorn, enjoy Coca-Cola. So Coca-Cola early on learned that, hey, we could get people to buy stuff if they don't know what we're doing to their brains. That's pretty powerful. Now, it's not limited to Coca-Cola, but they were the first. So I knew about that, just as you guys did. You know, we've heard about that. I studied advertising in college. You know, I learned this. I've studied psychology at all different levels. So that wasn't shocking to me. And I also knew about how George Bush's campaign video subliminally implanted the word rats when speaking about the other party. And you could probably find that on YouTube. I think it was in 2000. George Bush's campaign video, and it's not subtle once you know it. It's like the word just flashes on the screen very quickly, rats. And I think when confronted with it, they said, oh, that was an accident. So believe me, it wasn't an accident. The shit that I learned at this seminar is so out there, it's hard to believe it's true, but it is. And you could see it for yourself if you really start to explore. I'm going to give you a few insights. I'm going to ask you to trust that what I'm not telling you is the bizarre, unbelievable, unethical, I'm going to say, lengths that advertisers will go to sell products. The images used to move, in some cases, family-based wholesome products are completely pornographic. So let's start with this. In the 14th century, a French tale was popularized called the Tale of Messaline. Messaline was born of an enchanted mother and royalty. Her mother was sort of supernatural, and her father was a part of a royal family. And her mother insisted that this royalty could have her with one deal. When they have children, he could never, ever see them bathe. So he said, okay, I'm all right with that. I don't need to see my kids bathe. You're hot. I'm horny. Let's go. So they wound up together, and they had this child, Messaline. And for a very long time, nobody but the mother saw Messaline bathe. The story has morphed and changed in so many different directions over the centuries, but it started in France in the 14th century. And Messaline in water became a mermaid. So to this day, that story is kind of told in different ways, but that's where it started, this idea of get in water and it's a mermaid. The difference is Messaline, as she reached adulthood, was very sexual. She was very seductive. She was beautiful and manipulative. And even as a mermaid, she had sexual freedom. Now, this is something that has plagued men for years, is this idea of the mermaid. What do we do with them? Because they have the bottom half of a fish, right? So how far can this really go? But Messaline was different. She had a split tail. There was a left half and a right half. So if we can visualize it, it looked like sort of tail legs. And there was nothing, according to the legend, more seductive then Messaline holding one tail in each hand. So picture a seductive mermaid with all the necessary anatomical parts to please herself and please men, holding one tail in each hand. Why would I talk about this in a Be Better talk where I'm leading to subliminal advertising? Anybody know?
Starbucks.
Pornography sells.
No, Jason just hit it. What is it?
Starbucks.
Look at the Starbucks logo. Look at the Starbucks logo. I'm going to tell you this. People were paid a lot of money to design that logo. Now that I told you about Messaline holding one fishtail in each hand, being seductive and somehow just enchantingly compelling, look at the Starbucks logo. Now, all this seems kind of silly until you realize we're talking about millions of dollars changing hands for people to make these decisions. Now, is Starbucks successful because of the logo? No. But can we answer how much that subliminal contribution had to the company's success? I don't think we can. But as you look at more and more and more, you start to see some of these companies have spent millions of dollars on figuring out how to tap into the subconscious brain at a sexual, innate, bare level are hugely successful. There have been marketing studies where groups were brought in and asked to view an ad without judgment and just identify words or emotions that came to mind. And they look at an ad for like a glass of vodka. And when the words sexuality, pleasure, intimacy, or any words with distinct sexual connotation came up frequently, products sold better. So why would somebody look at vodka and think of sex? Well, that's exactly what the liquor distributors want. You guys know the association, so they want you to think of that. They don't want you to think of the taste. Maybe on the surface, you're going to look for something smooth and something that has a good taste. But they know that you make your decisions emotionally. You don't make your decisions rationally. You don't make your decisions if someone says, buy vodka. You make your decisions because you want to enjoy. So this isn't an accident. The words and images were embedded in the ads. And when you see it, that's the holy shit. I can't believe this. It's right there. They conveyed messages very effectively beneath the conscious level. And I'm telling you, the 10 best-selling liquors use subliminal advertising. Coincidence? I don't know, but you got to look at it and kind of go, huh? The images are masked in ice cubes in hundreds of beer and vodka and wine and gin ads. They're masked in designs and in backgrounds of many popular images that you'd never think twice about, even in some ads that use Disney characters, which is like offensive. But if it's going to sell product, they don't care. And honestly, some are so pornographic they couldn't be printed in magazines, even though they are printed in magazines. So do you guys have a picture of the guy lifting it, taking his shirt off? Anybody? I sent it in an email.
Yeah, I got it.
Okay. So what is that? What do you think of? Anybody know what product that is? Remember?
Looks like an old Soloflex ad.
That's it, Soloflex. Okay, so let's start with the name Soloflex. We know that the human mind is amazing. You guys have probably seen that exercise where the letters of a word are scrambled, but the first letter and the last letter are the same as the word, and you read it even though it's not in order. Have you guys seen that? So the word Soloflex was very calculated because they know your eyes go from the beginning of the word to the end of the word.
It's so funny.
Now, if you have the ad in front of you, I want you to look closely at his abs. Be prepared now. And know that this ad was heavily airbrushed. Do you notice anything? Look very closely at his abs. Is anybody looking at it right now?
Yeah, I don't see what you're talking about, though.
You do or you don't?
I don't.
Keep looking.
Is that mermaid in there?
No, no mermaid. When you see it, you'll see it. Who was that? Who said that?
Yeah, I see it now.
Is that crazy?
Yeah, it is crazy.
Is it crazy that nobody ever noticed it? And now that you see it.
Yeah.
Anyone else see it?
That's bananas.
No, it's not bananas.
That's banana.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You see it?
Yeah.
April, you have in front of you?
Yeah.
Oh, April fainted. Can you see it?
Yeah. Yep.
Do you see anything strange about the kind of shape of his abs?
Kim, come here. I got to show you something.
It is crazy. Am I right? All right. So those who don't see it, you know, keep looking later. You'll see it. When you see it, you'll see it. Nobody has abs exactly that shape. That's airbrushed. And it is with intention, and the name Solo Flex is very intentional. And that was a massive, massive infomercial success. It set records. And the truth is, it's not even a good piece of equipment. Do you guys agree?
Yeah.
We agree.
Guys bought it. They bought it. All right, now, there's something else called displacement, and this is another really weird thing. Displacement says that if your brain or mind looks at something and you know that the something is just an ad, you displace it. And if an image is stretched out side to side, like a landscape rather than portrait, if you were printing something on a page, your eyes will subconsciously fill in what looks like an ad with something linearly below it. Okay, so if you understand that, if you look at the Land O'Lakes butter image, you see she's holding the box? In your mind, move her knees up to where the box is. This is one of the advertisements that in focus groups and study groups had the most men come up with sexual just sexual thoughts. What does this make you think of? Huh. It's butter with an Indian princess kneeling. But it's this concept of displacement where your eyes take what's under it and move it up. Huh. I'm going to show you one more, and then I'm going to stop. But I want you to know, this is the soft stuff that I'm showing you. It is really crazy. And I think I understand why they had to have all that confidentiality, because really people should not know. They should not know how they are really, really being manipulated. And I have very mixed feelings about it. I mean, I'm fascinated. I mean, I feel like I learned so much. But also, it's like this is just wrong, I think, maybe. All right, you see the Coca-Cola ad that says, "Feel the curves"?
Yep.
This may take you a few minutes to notice, but bring your eyes to the bottom right, and there are some ice cubes there. And do you see in the bottle there are like four little dots, sort of a reflection, like dots of light?
Yeah.
If you look under that, there's an ice cube, and then there's another ice cube just below that in front of it. See if you can see an image in that ice cube.
Looks like a guy's head with a girl, I think.
Yeah, I don't see it.
Do you guys see it?
No.
I see a horse. Is that right?
If I had it in front of you, I would circle it and you'd see it.
Mm.
There's a head with a mouth,
mm-hmm.
and then there's something else that the mouth is kind of moving toward.
Oh, I see that.
See it?
Mm-hmm.
Towards the dots?
It
No, under it. Like, if you look at those four dots, look at the ice cube under those dots, and then look at the ice cube just below that one. That's kind of sideways.
Okay. Holy crap.
Isn't this amazing? Mm. And I'm telling you, hundreds of ads of major companies. Palmolive. I mean, all of these companies are just kind of looking wholesome when you see the subtle subliminal stuff that's in there. And by the way, much of this is completely illegal. According to the FTC laws, you're not allowed to do this. So the way to get away with it is, oh, we didn't know. No, it's just, oh, look at that. That's funny. So I could really do hours and hours and hours on this, because now I started looking at different ads and I'm finding stuff. And you guys will probably do the same thing. So the seminar went into depth about how to influence people. Now, keep in mind, this was aimed at financial marketers. And believe it or not, what drives people to make their decisions as to which financial marketing company, firm, bank they're going to use is the subconscious foundation of thoughts of power and sex. I know it sounds crazy, but the way this was laid out, indisputable. So in watching this, much of it was scary, but there were a couple of vital things I pulled from it that I don't think really infringe upon the agreements I signed. I'm a careful listener, and my RAS sometimes grabs words that it finds significant, and one of the speakers was explaining that the impact of a subliminal force is highly dependent upon the emotional programming. Let me say this again, because I know it sounds like a lot of words. I wrote this down. The subliminal force, so whatever it is, whether it's an image, a sound, something, subliminal force is highly dependent, meaning is it going to have the impact intended? The subliminal force is highly dependent upon the emotional programming controlled by subconscious habitation. That's what got me. That's when my RAS said, whoa, I get that. Subconscious habitation. I love that. Subconscious habitation. Consider a clubhouse in your brain, a treehouse in your brain. Make it a clubhouse. Make it like a cool boys clubhouse. And get an image of two thoughts playing in there. So your thoughts are playing in your playhouse. Subconscious habitation. The thoughts live in your subconscious. You find thoughts and they move right in and they live in there. And they're moving around. And how you respond to stimuli is dependent upon what's going on in your subconscious playhouse. I want you to, if you can do what I just said, imagine a clubhouse in your brain and imagine some thoughts, just thoughts playing in there, whatever your representation is of those thoughts. And now imagine that there is a thought at the door about to come in and you let it in and it is a thought about your finances. So in your mind, envision that. The thought about your finances has just come in to habitate, to live in the clubhouse. And as you're thinking about this and visualizing, give that thought some material traits and have it enter the clubhouse. So just in your mind right now, give it some material traits. What does it look like? You're creating a vision of this thought of finances. Now, some of you might have seen the thought as green. Some of you might have seen it shiny, like a coin. Some of you might have seen it smiling. These all depend upon your perceptions of finance. Others might have seen it as tense. Some gave the thought arms and legs and it walked into the clubhouse. Others had it moving like a fog or a cloud. And this is something valuable to understand. Each one of us has our own clubhouse, but the inhabitants of your clubhouse are completely different than mine. Even though you have thoughts of finance and I have thoughts of finance that live in my subconscious, they're different. Like fingerprints, they are all completely different. Nobody has your clubhouse. So subliminal marketing for the masses, it is based on innate thinking, not developed thinking. In other words, most of the effective subliminal ads don't use images of dogs or babies. Even though we're told, you know, when we learn about marketing that, you know, those kind of images are good. They attract attention. You know, you want to sell something, put a baby in there. But at a subconscious level, that's risky because they don't know your images of babies. You might hate babies. You might have had really negative experiences that you link with babies. You might have negative experiences that you link with dogs. So that's too risky. They don't look for developed thinking. If they want to impact the masses, they look for innate thinking, which is why most of the effective subliminal ads have played into two concepts, sex and power, because those are innate. Those are not developed. Those are innate. They are innate limbic system desires. And what do we know is controlled in the limbic system? Emotions. So it is emotion that creates this impulse to act or buy. We know that. But what's really cool is the emotion can be stimulated without the person's awareness that it's even happening. So understand, our conscious brain activity is very much the same. In other words, we all process possibility in the prefrontal cortex. We all do that. That's all of us. That's the sameness, just like we bend from the knee. We all process fear by connecting the limbic system with the amygdala and the hypothalamus. We all do that. So we're the same in this regard. Mechanically, our conscious thoughts are the same. We are all limited in action by the EEM. We are all stimulated by the RAS and by the neurotransmission stimulated in the nucleus accumbens. So conscious thought is the same. Our subconscious activity is personally unique. And for that reason, you benefit by coming to understand the thoughts that you allow into your clubhouse, the thoughts that find subconscious habitation in your brain. And, you know, I know this is kind of fun and interesting, and I really, it really wouldn't serve you guys for me to do more because you get the message with the subliminal advertising. But I am telling you, it is amazing. It is amazing. And for a guy who studies influence, I've just taken so much from this. Now, I'm not telling you guys to put pornography on your business cards. That's not the message here. But let's understand why those things work to influence people and how we can utilize them and still, of course, remain ethical and not do things underhanded or sneaky. I said at the beginning of this call, I learned from people. We all learn from people. And anyone who is a parent, I heard somebody say, I think Tony said, we learn from our children. We learn not only from our children, but also through the experiences we have with our children. And I just went through something interesting with my daughter, Brooke. She got into a school which you had to audition for, and a very small percentage of the kids who audition get in. It is a public school, which is fantastic because we don't have to pay for it like we would a private school. But they do incredible fundraising, and I think I told you guys when I was kind of exploring this idea of strategic philanthropy, I gave a pretty nice donation to the school. I don't know if it has anything to do with why we're being treated the way we are right now, but I just gave them another one. So Brooke had all of these friends. She was in fifth grade, elementary school. She knew all the kids. You know, I'd pick her up. Hi, Brooke. Bye, Brooke. See you, Brooke. Bye, Brooke. See you tomorrow. So she went from that, and she was the tallest kid in her school. And although I hate this, she looks like she's 16 and she's 11. Believe me, I hate it. But she does. So now she started this new school, and she doesn't look like any of the kids in her grade. She looks like the eighth graders, but she's really not. So she felt very alienated. None of her friends went to the school. She takes a bus to school, and it's about an hour ride from the time it picks her up. So she got into this great school, but the first week she really, really had a hard time, and she'd come home crying every day. And, you know, we just said, it's the first week, you'll make friends, you'll get used to it. You know, it's a big change going from elementary school to middle school. But that first week, she hated school, and she cried. She wanted to go to Woodlands, which is the school that she zoned for near her mom's house. Woodlands is not a great school, and this Bach, where she goes, Bach School of the Arts, is a fantastic school. But, of course, I don't want my daughter to be unhappy, so you want to do the right thing. You just don't know what the right thing is. But, you know, we decided, and when I say we, I mean my ex-wife, Amy, Brooke's mom and I decided that the first week is going to be rough on her. The second week will be better. So the second week I was in Pittsburgh, and I got calls every night, first from crying Brooke and then from her mom after Brooke went to sleep. And her mom was ready to move her into the other school. She said, "You don't understand. You're not here. Why do you want your daughter to suffer? We need to put her in this Woodland school." I said, "Amy, listen, I'm going to get on a plane and come home. I'm going to cut my trip short. I'm going to come home. But I want you to make me a promise. Do not transfer her into any other school. We need to go see it. We need to go on a tour of the school. So if you want to make an appointment, I'm going to come home and you can make the appointment." So she made the appointment, but they couldn't make it for about another 10 days. I came home. Brooke was okay. I drove her to school in the morning. The following week, I went back out of town, and I got calls, same thing. But this time, Amy's going, "She needs a psychiatrist." She said, "I'm telling you, Brooke, our daughter has depression. She needs a psychiatrist. She has anxiety." Now, my ex-wife has a master's degree in psychology. So according to her, I'm a sociopath and a narcissist. Everybody's something. And I said, "Amy, please, like, don't think that way, because I travel around the country telling people not to get labels. Doctors don't label people. And here you are saying my daughter's depressed when she's never shown signs of depression before. But you don't see it. It's really severe." So I said, "Call the guidance counselor at her school." And she did. And Brooke went to see the guidance counselor. And that became kind of a safe haven. Like, Brooke knew that now she could leave the class if she's really unhappy and go talk to the guidance counselor, Miss Jackson. And then when I came back, I met with the assistant principal, who I had met when I did that initial thing, my donation. And she said she would talk to Brooke, and she did. And now Brooke had two kind of allies in school. And then she met yet another guidance counselor from another grade. And they all really were supportive. And I know I'm making this story long, but there's really, really a lesson here. So this was really difficult. And I kept going out of town. I was in Chicago. I was supposed to be there 3 days. I came home the next day. I did my talk. I got right on a plane. Because when I was away, it became this crisis mode. Last Friday was a significant day. And this morning was significant. That's why this is fresh in my mind. Last week, she had a decent week in school. And Friday was a good day. Okay, so last week was the first week that it kind of got better as the week went on, and Friday was a good day. Now, Sunday night, Brooke was with me in my house, and at about 7:30, she started crying. I said, "What's the matter?" She said, "I have to call Mom." I said, "Okay, call Mom." She called Mom. She goes, "Mom, I'm upset." And Amy just kind of said, "You're with your dad now. You don't talk to him." So I said, "What are you upset about?" She said, "Tomorrow's Monday, and Mondays are always terrible." Now, it's interesting because I study influence, I use influence, but when it's your own kid, it's harder. It is. However, with children, you can put the programs in much easier, because when you're dealing with adults, they have like malware and viruses. I mean, they've got, you know, I can't, everything's running through their head. So when you're dealing with an 11-year-old, at some level it's easier. And I really try to look at it this way. You know, what can I do to kind of influence her? Because I see what she's doing. She's globalizing. She's thinking every Monday is bad, every Monday is bad, every Monday is bad. I said, "Brooke, we're going to change the station right now. Here's what I want you to think. I want you to say Friday was a great day." Just say it. "No, I can't." Just say it. Friday was a great day. Okay, good. Say it again without the crying. "Friday was a great day." Okay, say it again. "Friday was a great day." Good. Now I want you to follow it with, "And Monday can be better." "But it won't." No. I just want you to say it. I just want you to say, "But Monday can be better. And Monday can be better." "But it won't be." You don't know that it won't be. It hasn't happened yet. So I'm not saying it will be better. I'm just saying it can. There's a possibility. I want you to say that. And I had her say it over and over and over again, ultimately in her head. And within 30 minutes, she was happy. She was goofy. We had dinner. We watched a show, and she went to bed. I was really happy that we went through that experience. But the real question was Monday going to be better? Because if it wasn't, then Dad's a liar. So that was this past Monday. Monday, she had a good day in school. Tuesday, she had a better day in school. Now, this morning, Amy and I had a meeting with the two guidance counselors and the principal. Brooke is an ideal student. She is loving school. And get this, she's volunteered to pay it forward. She wants to talk to other kids who become anxious about the future. So then they took Brooke out of class and brought her into the meeting, and she was surprised, you know, and we all applauded her. And, you know, Brooke, you did this. You know, you turned it around. And then Miss Jackson asked Brooke, she said, so, Brooke, what did you do to turn this around? And Brooke said, I told myself it would be a good day. And then once that happened, I told myself it would be a good week. So when I say we learn from our kids, I mean, I took a role in initiating that. But just sitting there, I really felt such a tremendous sense of pride because did it work? Yeah. Now, is it the sole reason? No. I think I had a nice team here assembled. You know, I'm thankful the school was very supportive of her. And does it have anything to do with the fact that I gave a generous donation? I don't know. I really don't know. Certainly didn't hurt. But it played a part, the thought, over and over and over again. Friday was a great day. There's a reference point. There's a stone. There's something you can attach to. Friday was a great day. And Monday can be better. It's just possibility. But what does possibility do? It goes to the prefrontal cortex. So by saying it again and again and again, what's happening? You're creating a new neural pathway. I think it's the same thing that the gratitude journal did for Velma. Every day, creating that neural pathway. At first, it was hard for her to find gratitude for even three things. Then before you know it, it's like today she's probably doing 500 things she's thankful for today. Very similar to April creating in her mind future outcomes, even though at first that was really hard for her, and getting comfortable with thoughts like, I am powerful, because that somehow allowed April to manifest her own studio. So understand this. It isn't the affirmation that's possible, at least not in and of itself. It isn't the affirmation that has the power. The affirmation is simply the tool. It is inviting new, better thoughts into your clubhouse, because when you fully integrate a new thought into your subconscious or into your subconscious habitation, you cannot help but get rid of the negative thought. In other words, once you know Monday can be good, you never again have the thought every Monday's bad. Once you know you own your own studio, you'll never again have the thought, I can never own my own studio. Once you find 10 things in a day to be thankful for, you can never have the thought that I don't have anything to be thankful for. So it's that subconscious habitation. That's why I love it. Sometimes, you know, some terminology just crystallizes for me, and this did it. So someone living in a cave might believe the sky is dark. If they've never been out of the cave and they've heard about sky, they look up and they go, the sky is dark, the sky is brown, the sky is muddy, and the sky is filled with bats. And they believe that. And it might be a deeply held belief until someone lets them out of the cave. And now they have a new recognition of the sky, and they go, the sky is beautiful, and there are clouds, and it's vast, and it's eternal. With a new recognition of the sky, they cannot possibly hold on to the old belief. So when you invite a new belief into your subconscious habitation, the old beliefs go away. So I created an acronym, and it will become a part of my internal and external vocabulary from this day forward. Did you ever wish for something and it came true? Did anybody ever do that? And whether you said it's God, it's the universe, it's luck, did anybody ever wish for something and it came true?
Absolutely.
Anyone other than Tony?
Yes.
Yes.
Can you think of an example? Anybody think of an example, just something you wished for?
In high school, I wished a particular girl would ask me to the prom.
And?
And she did.
See, I wished that Lisa Joseph would kiss me when I was 8 years old. I did. I wished it. And she did. I wished that I would have a career as a personal trainer. There's no way I could have had a career as a personal trainer. Personal trainers didn't have careers, but I wished it. It came true. I wished I'd live in Florida. I had no ability to live in Florida. I grew up in New York. I wished I'd have a home on the water with my own pool. I wished I'd own a health club. I wished I'd have a grand piano in my home. It's when the wish becomes a belief shift. It's when the wish becomes a belief shift. It's when it goes from, I wish I have a good day Monday, to, I'm having a great day, Mondays are good. It's when that happens that your programming changes. When the wish becomes a belief shift, the programs that you're running in your subconscious mind morph, and you start running new decision strategies. So here's the acronym I came up with, and I love it. Will into subconscious habitation. That's what we want people to do. We want them to will things into subconscious habitation. The acronym is WISH. Will into subconscious habitation. The word willpower was coined by William James. I'm a huge fan of William James, who is sort of a rebel psychologist and challenged a lot of the theories of Sigmund Freud, and he came up with this idea of willpower. And I love the way he coined the phrase, because we tend to use it differently now. People talk about willpower as if it's just something some people have and some people don't. And what he said is we all have will. Human will is something that is inherent in all of us, even as children. It's what makes the child want for the bottle or the breast. It's what makes the child want the ball. It's what makes you get out of bed in the morning. We all have will. The question becomes, do we exercise our power of will? And I think when you take that wish, that desire, that's something you want. You know, I'm going through an interesting time because I decided I'm going to do one more baseline Be Better group. And I spoke to Tasso about this. I'm going to actually bring in some medical professionals. And this is the last Be Better group I'm going to initiate. And then it's moving into the world of medicine. And you guys will be connected with that, by the way. But I've been screening people. You know, they fill out the application. I've been screening them. And I'm really, I shouldn't be shocked anymore. But I really just feel like knocking on the door and going, are you serious? And it's wrong of me. I should be more empathetic at this point. But the simple question is, what do you want? And they can't answer it. They think they're answering it. They think they're answering it. What do you want? I want to own my own business. Okay. What does that mean? Studio. Okay, well, tell me about that studio. Functional training. No, no, no. You got to tell me. What does the studio look like? What's your life going to be like? Tell me what you want. I don't want to work for somebody. I mean, these are the dialogues that I have. So it's really interesting how they can't even articulate the wish. And I think it starts with that. I think you got to have the wish. Everybody who comes to you as a prospective client has a wish. They wish to be better. Otherwise, they wouldn't be talking to you. So it starts with the wish. But why do so many of them fail to follow through? Because they haven't taken it and willed it into subconscious habitation. They haven't tapped into the emotion that locks it into their subconscious and makes it a must. And it's really cool to know that we can have some influence over that. We can have some power over that. Wish. Will into subconscious habitation. If you realize that power is not so much in the action or the medication or the affirmation, but rather the introduction of a new thought being willed into subconscious habitation, you realize at a heightened level your power to influence. And this has value for you in three different areas. One, your personal growth. If you're understanding this, then you can use this to overcome whatever has held you back from getting to whatever you wish for. Secondly, your impact upon clients. If you realize that there is an opportunity to influence them subconsciously, and you can foster the cementing of a new belief by getting them to will things into conscious habitation, you will speak differently with people. And then once you really start to master some of this, it will help your interaction with partners and associates and business affiliates. So really three areas, you, your clients, and any business affiliates you connect with. Here's an important point. A wish only gets willed into subconscious habitation if the emotion is strong enough. a wish only gets willed into subconscious habitation if the emotion is strong enough. I'm going to share with you guys, I'm going to email you guys a link to a webinar I did. It's a YouTube link. But I'm going to share with you, it's a Navaka webinar that I did for chiropractors, specifically for chiropractors, a small group of chiropractors, or Dr. Pompa's students. Because I think you'll hear that the emotion is such an important piece of it. And it's not about selling fitness. It's about selling hope. It's about connecting with somebody who believes you're the vehicle. And I'll tell you what prompted that webinar. I had a conversation with Marty and Jay. They are two chiropractor brothers. They live in the Midwest. And they're successful. But they've stepped into this world now of expanding things and running more of a cash business and connecting with the idea of functional medicine or functional nutrition. And now they're selling a program that is about $8,000. It's a six-month program. It includes interaction with the patients on different levels. And the way that they promote the program is through seminars. So understand what it is. It's the reach, the funnel, the spillover. It's exactly what I do and what I teach people to do. We market. We meet people. We meet five people a day. We invite them to an orientation or a seminar. The seminar is the funnel. Some people will pass through and become your clients or patients or customers. So they were doing a really good job with the seminars, and they were getting a good conversion rate of people who'd come in for the initial appointment. But when they presented the $8,000 program, they had people say, I want to think about it. I need to check with my spouse. They'd leave and they'd never come back. So they were doing well, but they weren't hitting it. They weren't hitting really what they wanted. And you know, I am all about influence, but I'm not about closing. So they called me and they go, how do we learn to close? And I go, well, no, don't learn to close. There's something you can do differently. And we spoke about it, and that's what prompted this webinar. So I'll give you guys the link. It's a lot of what you know, but I think you'll enjoy it. I looked at their video, and what I realized is they find the need, but they did it very linear. So tell me what's going on. The person goes, well, I'm tired. Okay, we got the need. They're tired. They failed to elicit emotion. So I worked with these guys to understand that the why, the real reason, if you read Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, you know, it's all about the why. The underlying why is never logical. It's never, I'm tired and I don't want to be tired anymore. It's never, I think I should buy popcorn. It isn't logical. It's emotional. Nobody will pay $6,000 or $8,000 for their functional nutrition program because the person's hair is falling out and they're tired. Those are the symptoms. Those are the prompts that drove them there, but that's not why they're going to pay $6,000 or $8,000. They'll pay $6,000 or $8,000 if they connect with the thought that sends a subconscious eruption through their entire body. A thought that says something like, if I don't get well, my kids will starve. Or if I don't get well, my kids will be orphans. Now, do we really want them to experience that? I'd like them to experience the thought because that's the kind of thought that prompts the change. Do we want to inflict pain? Of course not. We hate inflicting pain. But if that's what it takes to get them to act, to move in a positive direction, then it's the emotion. That's why the alternatives phase of Navaka is so important, because they go into the future and they start to feel these feelings, and it is purely emotional. So it all comes down to changing subconscious habitation with emotion. So if Marty and Jay make some of these changes, now we have the question. We understand that them accessing the emotion will prompt them to at least consider paying the $6,000 or $8,000. But now the bigger question is, will they pay the $6,000 or $8,000 to Marty and Jay? Meaning they might sit there and they might go, yes, I need to do something. Okay, thanks, guys. I'm going to go find, you know, and they'll look for something else. So will they? Yes, if they believe these guys are the vehicle. And that's a determining factor. If you're influencing somebody, if you're changing their subconscious habitation, if you're tapping into their emotions, they must believe that you're the vehicle to get them there. So if you change somebody's thinking as to whether or not they can commit to an exercise program, if you change somebody's thinking as to whether or not they can eat better, and you actually change it, but they don't believe you're the vehicle to take them there, they'll thank you and they'll go somewhere else. Tasso, do you remember the Commit to Get Fit campaign?
Yes, I do.
That was really well intended, and it was really a flop. I mean, it was big. It was big. A lot went into it, and all the equipment companies got behind it, and it was an URSA-run program where every club got banners and flyers, and everything was under the heading, the slogan of Commit to Get Fit. And it just didn't work. It didn't work. You would think it was working if you went into the health clubs because you'd see it everywhere, right? Commit to Get Fit. T-shirts. But understand, commit to get fit is one of those commands that is logical. It's not emotional. A penis in a guy's abs gets people more than commit to get fit. How bizarre is that? But that's the truth. That's what we're talking about. We're dealing with the human brain. You've got to get to emotion. Don't be a miserable, crying, fat slob in the future. That might have worked better than commit to get fit. Now, it's wrong. Of course, we wouldn't make banners that say that. But let's understand the power we have when we tap into emotion. So we don't want to say that to people, but we certainly want them to think that if we're going to get them to act. So when you do a talk or seminar, when Marty and Jay, these chiropractors, do a talk or a seminar, you have the ability to affect thoughts. Tasso, when you do a talk, you have the ability to affect thoughts. You have the ability to eliminate conflicting thoughts. In other words, if somebody comes to you thinking the drugs are working. Right? I've spoken about thyroid quite a bit in the past. The reason I love speaking about thyroid is because it's such a massive medical miss. When somebody has a thyroid problem, it's caused by something else. But the endocrinologist just looks at the labs and says, we're going to give you thyroid hormone in some form, whether it's Cytomel or Armour Thyroid or Synthroid. And then they say, hey, guess what? You're normal now. And the person's not normal. They're still tired. They're still feeling horrible. They're still gaining weight. But the doctor goes, no, the medication's working. So Tasso's seminar starts with people sitting there thinking, the medication's working, but I'm still fat. See, that's a flawed belief, but it's still a belief. It was ingrained in their head. The medication's working. You revere the doctor's knowledge. The doctor told you the medication's working. Now, in three or four sentences, Tasso can help them understand that the thyroid issue is not a thyroid issue, and suddenly that other belief goes out the door. So by changing what they allow into their clubhouse, we can change their behavior. So the seminar gives you an ability to affect thoughts, to eliminate conflicting thoughts, and it gives you an ability to connect. And there's a process. And this is what I shared with Marty and his brother, Jay. The first thing that has to happen in terms of response to you is the individual brain sitting in that room has to connect with the thought, I hear what you're saying. I hear what you're saying. Has anybody here ever gone to a really boring lecture and you couldn't even hear what they were saying? I mean, if somebody said, what did they just say, you'd probably be able to kind of recall, he said the molecule is. But did you ever have that where you're just kind of sitting there and you just realize you're not even hearing anything? So the first thing that has to happen is there's that connection where you're talking and they get to that milestone, I hear what you're saying. The next step in the person's mind is, I like what you're saying. So that's another step forward. So I hear what you're saying means you got my interest. I like what you're saying means you're starting to compel me. You're saying the right things. You're speaking to me in the way I need to be spoken to. But the third one is the big one. And that is, I believe what you're saying. I believe what you're saying. When they get to that point, they are ripe. But they are not ready to pick yet. Because there's one more important piece. I hear what you're saying, goes to I like what you're saying, goes to I believe what you're saying, and the piece after that is, I like what I see when I look into the future and see you in my life. I'm going to say that again because this is when it happens. I like what I see when I look into the future and see you in my life. And really what that translates to is, I know you're the vehicle to get me there. So if you do a seminar and people go, great talk, man, wow, really learned a lot, they mean it. But they may shake your hand and leave and never come back. Not because they didn't believe you, not because they didn't like what you were saying, because they didn't see you as the vehicle. So if they're going, you know what, I'm going to go back to my doctor with this information, then you didn't finish the influence process. And if you start to really put all these pieces together, then I don't think anybody should escape you. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean, anyone who you could help, if you understand you need to impact them emotionally, change the subconscious thoughts they're harboring, and get them to go through that process. I hear you. I like what you're saying. I believe what you're saying. I like what I see when I look in the future and see you in my life. That's why the alternatives phase is so powerful. Because understand what they're doing. You're not giving them linear thoughts. You're sending them into a place where they're thinking emotional thoughts. And first you take them down a path where they're going to feel negative emotions, and then you take them down a path where they feel positive emotions. And the way you prompted it is, if you make some of the changes we discussed, what will life be like? So realize now they're envisioning the changes that will take place with you as their guide. That's why it's so effective. So imagine the limbic system as that clubhouse in your brain having a revolving door. And when you're working to influence a client or prospect, you envision yourself as the doorman at that door because you're sending out the negative thoughts and you're bringing in the ones you want to implant at a subconscious level. In a 2008 study by Dr. Soon, published in the Journal of Neuroscience, it was demonstrated that the brain is subconsciously aware of our decisions before we have consciously made those decisions. This is really eye-opening. The subconscious mind is aware of the decision before you know you make it. It's nuts, but it's true.
That reminds me of the Malcolm Gladwell book, Blink.
Yeah, exactly right. Yep. Yeah, and what year was that book? Because this is from 2008, so it's probably around the same time of kind of revelation.
Yeah.
Probably around that same time, right?
Probably, yeah.
So the research study was interesting because participants in the study were asked to make a decision about whether they would use their left hand or their right hand to press a lever. But they used functional MRI, where they can track scans of brain activity. And the researchers knew the participants' decision, not 20% of the time, not 80% of the time, 100% of the time before the action, by analyzing the activity in the frontopolar cortex of the brain, a part of the prefrontal cortex. Sometimes this information was available to the researcher from the subconscious, direct subconscious to researcher. The conscious brain got it later, up to 7 seconds before the person made the conscious decision, with 100% accuracy. In a follow-up study taking that, they did a study with 36 participants predicting every decision they would make because the subconscious made it first. So, you know, all these things get a little scary if you overanalyze it. I mean, does it mean we don't have free will, that we're controlled by our subconscious? No. We're in control if we recognize we're putting in the data. We're putting into our subconscious clubhouse whatever we want. It's just most people do it unconsciously. I'm telling you, we could do it consciously. If we learn what to allow through that revolving door, then our subconscious makes better decisions before we even know those decisions are being made. So how cool is that, that you could do a seminar, and even before they say, yes, I'm going to do it, they've made the decision. In that alternatives phase, I'm telling you, that's where the decision's made before they even know they're going to do it. So I thought about giving everybody here an exercise, and then I thought, you know what I want to do, if you guys are up for it, I'd like everyone to just experiment with this information. I'd like you to try to behave differently with the next five people you work with, or the next five events, or the next five talks you give. I'd like you to just think about what I shared with you and start to kind of analyze, what can I do to just try to implant those better subconscious thoughts? What can I do to change these beliefs? How can I speak to the subconscious a little bit more than I have been? How can I get away from this idea of telling people they need to do it because point A, point B, point C that I learned from ACSM? How can I really speak to the emotion? How can I get them to have the thought without me specifically telling them this, that if I don't start to work out with you, I will die? And I know when I say it, it sounds horrible, but the thing is, I'm never going to say it. I just want them to go into that alternative future and see where they're headed. Because when they have a thought like that, that's it. That's the new belief in the clubhouse. That shows up, and everybody else in the clubhouse starts to shake. We're going to die. Uh-oh. We better change something. Jason Bryce, are you here?
He was.
I'm here.
Hey, Jason. Jason, I'm just going to ask you for an update before I wrap it up. I just want to get an update of what's going on. And for people who weren't on the last call when Jason joined us, he's been a part of this group for a long time, and he decided to leave the industry after a chain of events, and now he's sort of feeling that pull to come back, and he's seeing some real opportunity now and might be able to come back in a big way. So what's happened, and I got some of your emails or texts, but just for the group, what's happened?
Well, he sent basically a proposal to the guys thinking about investing in maybe investing in a health club, and it's changed a little bit since last time. They asked me to actually think bigger and send a bigger proposal to them, like I guess for a full-size health club. And there's more properties that he has than I thought. First, he was just talking about Titusville, but he's got property in Port Orange and East Orlando and a few others. And the next step they want me to do is send in a marketing plan. So
okay.
That's kind of where we basically made past one hurdle. They wanted me to send in numbers, and of course I inflated the numbers. Michael told me to send them big, and I was kind of caught on my heels because I inflated everything and found the nicest and most expensive of everything, and I really sent that in thinking he'd, you know, laugh at that and tell me to.
What, you mean numbers as far as spending? Numbers as far as costs?
Right, yeah, cost and spending.
Okay.
Yeah, really.
Okay, it's good to inflate those, yes.
Yeah, I inflated that and sent it in, and of course not knowing how much it costs for the building and stuff, but they, word came back, he didn't care about that at all. That was fine, just as long as he get some money back with profit. Of course, he knows that the health clubs have a tendency, the guy's not an idiot, but he knows health clubs a lot of times go bankrupt or don't make it. So, you know, but really it was, you know, that part was fine. They were just wanting a marketing plan, but it really stuck on them where they brought it up actually at the beginning of the untapped market of, they call it 40 to 60-year-old professionals and the retirees in Florida. Of course, what they, without using the language of unwell, is really what they were talking about. So just sending in stuff and learn from Be Better in the Past, I think, is what really gets their attention.
So did you put together any kind of marketing plan?
I'm in the middle of doing that now.
All right. So you're doing that comp?
No, not that far comp, no.
You charging for it?
Charging? No. But not a business plan, just marketing. Basically, I have a market, and I'm just putting in the 5-a-day, stuff like that right now.
Okay. Jason, if I were you, next step, because here's what's going on. You have an investor, and the investor cares about making money. And, you know, you understand that. He doesn't care about you. He doesn't care about your family. He doesn't even care about the people who come to the health club. He doesn't care about the manager. He doesn't care about the janitor, right? He cares about a return on his money. That's the reality, right? So,
right, and that's fine with me.
So somebody who is an investor looks at the value of things. That's what they do. you know, if you ever go down to like the diamond district in the major city and you see the guys with that eyepiece and they're looking at the diamond, they're assessing value. That's what an investor does. If it's a real estate investor, they look at the real estate. They look at the house. They look at the property. They look at the neighborhood. They look at the comps. So you got to realize that you are a commodity to him. You're not a person. You have no emotional value to him. You're a commodity. And by doing a marketing plan for him, what is the value of this commodity?
Right.
So I think what you should do, since you've already committed to it, is do a very baseline marketing plan with a proposal to create something more specific for X number of dollars.
Right. That's all he asked for at first. It's very, you know, basic marketing plan, what I'm after kind of thing.
Yeah, but I don't even mean a plan. I mean just a basic one page, you know, saying here's what I could put together for you. You know, I could
okay.
put together a plan outlining how we would run advertising. Now, I'll tell you something else. I know a guy who does SEO, and he does very well. He has a six-figure business. He's a great guy. I just spent some time with him in Atlanta. And he doesn't do any of the work. He basically collects accounts. And he learns. He goes to seminars. He learns stuff. But all of his work is contracted out. Now, his clients don't know that. And if they did, I don't think they would care because they hire him to get a better return on their internet investments. And he gives them that. So what I'm saying is you don't have to be an expert in putting together marketing plans to collect money and hire somebody to do it with you.
Okay.
So you're at a point right now that he's going to assess – consciously and subconsciously, what Jason Bryce is worth to him. And the more you do for him for free, the less your value. You get that now, right? I mean, you know that from all the years we've spoken about that.
Right. It's basically going back to the free personal training session.
Okay.
I mean, as far as setting your value at zero.
Exactly right, yep. I mean, if you can kind of take that and create that analogy, you're at a higher level now. So no longer are you the personal trainer doing the comp session. Now you're the guy who wants to come in and run the health club giving a comp marketing plan. So I'm just saying find that line for yourself where you go, hey, here's what I'm giving you. And now if you want me to go to the next step, it's going to be X number of dollars. And you'll have to, you know, figure out what that value is and what you do for that money. Tasso, can you comment on this at all?
A little bit, because when I heard Port Orange, my ears perked up because I'm familiar with that. That's 20 minutes away from me, and I know the market real well. And
so what you're saying is you don't want Jason to be your competition?
No, I don't care if he's competition.
I'm
not,
kidding.
Because we'll have a different product, is what it sounds like. But when I hear you speak, you know, sort of like putting together, said, listen, what we got to do is put together an internal, external, and cap program, and this is how we'll run it, and we'll talk about the vehicles for it, and here's the competitive markets that are there already. There's a very strong Y. There's an LA Fitness. Here's these personal training centers, and boom. Now I'll show you how to infiltrate and where our niche will be. That's a one-page proposal, it says, but it's going to cost you $1,000 a month for me to work on this.
Yeah, and I would say significantly more, but yes, that's it.
Okay.
Anyone else? Any thoughts? Because I think Jason has a real opportunity here. I think this is an investor who really doesn't care to know details of the industry. And
now
the
only thing I know from the best, basically he's actually younger than me. His parents were killed in a car wreck when he was young. The truck driver's at fault. He got $5 million in court, and he's turned it into $27 million right now.
Nice.
So he's not an idiot, he knows, and he knows enough about the health clubs that, you know, he knows about the high failure rate. He knows all that. But I looked around, and Port Orange is actually the one city I'd been to. Just looking around, they just got a new LA Fitness this time last year.
Yeah, they just got a brand new LA Fitness, and actually Orange Theory is supposed to go in there, but Orange Theory cannot find any property that fits into their model financially to make it work.
Let me tell you this. If Orange Theory, I know this company very, 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 very well. If Orange Theory wants to go in there, the demographics are really strong. And companies like Orange Theory are not afraid of LA Fitness. They realize that they get the shit that comes through there because people don't stick. They know that. So, yeah, if Orange Theory is looking there, you got a good demographic and probably reasonable real estate still.
The franchise has already been sold there, Phil. The franchise has already been sold there. They just can't find a location for it at this point in the town. That's the scenario I talked to you about when I talked to the guy, the CFO of Orange Theory.
Yeah, and Orange Theory, I think, is such a different animal than Jason would create that it complements it in a sense. But I'm just saying if the demographic supports Orange Theory and LA Fitness, that's a good demographic to be in. I wouldn't say that if LA Fitness ate up 80% of the market and Orange Theory took the other 20%, but that's not the way it works. So I think those are good signs. Those are very good signs. But, Jason, start to just think about your true value, and really at a certain point you just have to say, here's what I'm worth.
Yeah, and I know the guy's very hands-off, like he doesn't, you know, want to only ownership anything like that at all. All he's interested in is, rent check and return on investment. That's it.
Yeah, believe me, I know him. I mean, not personally, but I've met him many times over. And what I'm telling you is he doesn't care about the minutiae. He doesn't. He wants to get a return on his money. So when you say he knows about health clubs, he knows about the high failure rate, guarantee you, Jason, he doesn't know about health clubs.
Okay.
Doesn't. And probably doesn't care to.
Right.
So,
he doesn't know the ins and outs of health clubs. The only thing he knows about health clubs is, you know, they fail off.
Right. So if he keeps kind of saying to you, yeah, put this together for me. All right, put that together for me. Let's take a look at that. Then you're just sort of just a free commodity that he has access to. So I'm saying create some value for yourself. And then if you can give him a little bit of education about how he can really create an investment that brings a return, you become more valuable. And the time to start building that is now. And I didn't suggest by any means he's an idiot. Clearly he's not an idiot. But that doesn't mean that he's ever going to have interest in the business. He'll only have interest in a P&L statement, which
right,
is sometimes really good.
Yeah, actually, I mean, that's fine with me, and a lot of times it's actually, you know, I'd rather deal with that than somebody who knows just enough to get in the way and try to micromanage.
Correct. Okay, very good. The other Jason, you want to just kind of give an update? You and I have spoken, but for the group.
Yeah, things are so far going well. They're still very excited, still want to be a part of this. The latest emails I got from the director is that they still simply just want, is it a medically based program, and is there data to support the results that we're claiming? And I kind of chuckled to myself saying, well, of course, it's kind of all of that. So we're just, I'm excited about it. I still see a great potential. Phil's helping me with some of my language and some of just the stuff, like I said, I don't know what I don't know, and as far as how to operate in the rooms of the people I'm meeting with. But myself and Bob as well, this is kind of what we feel, this is what we've been working towards and planning towards, so we're fully on board with what's going to happen going forward and try and get this thing to be a done deal in the next, let's say, month or so, and then go from there. Probably going to do like a trial program with them, try to get at least 12 people into the program and prove to them firsthand that it can be done. Whether they want their staff to be trained as a life coaches or not, I don't know yet. That's a discussion to be had in the future here. Either way, trying to deliver value, get paid at a professional level, and really start pushing this Alive program forward as much as possible.
Very good. Anybody else, any thoughts, comments, questions on anything I spoke about? Anything we covered today? Any thoughts on what I discussed regarding willing things into subconscious habitation?
Bill, you know, as you spoke, the interesting thing that I think kept running through my mind, and I'm trying to run the video of that through my mind, was, you know, I've been doing the Healthy Mind and Body program. And we got off track. I started to tell you today that since I started doing that, I've noticed some things occurring personally to me. But
mm-hmm.
I
good
also,
things, right?
Yes, absolutely. I mm-hmm. also think there's a marriage going on that from the day that we started with the disease continuum as a way to show how we're different than other personal trainers that I use at the outset of my presentation, starts to make that emotional tie to a person that has them begin to see their future if they don't change their habits.
Right.
So it's starting to get that, alternative scenario placed for them. I think that some of the things I've done in the Body and Mind program are helping me from the standpoint of communicating things better out of gratitude to people. But this is by no way is an endorsement for it. But I got to tell you that in sitting down with that Quantum Infinity deal and doing that, things like that little protocol, just going and saying, hey, look, here's the body systems, it really links them. It's like it's making such a large difference in the way we finish up the consultation with them. Because I've started to just do it with some of the protocols that Casey put together, the oils and that, and also now with the isogenics I placed in it. It's sort of neat how it really does. Once you have now, I would say this: Casey went to Tammy's and did a day of consultations over there.
Mm-hmm.
Not as successful as it was here, with after they came to the presentation and Casey did the reading and then they sat down with me to go through it. That it really drove it forward. That was one of our larger months that we ever did in selling the different products that we associated with the profile. So it's interesting how those tools come together to help it. My mind was just trying to put it through.
Do you think they feel a greater connection with you?
I absolutely do think that, yeah, because there's a bigger trust.
So when they're hearing Casey, remember what I said. I hear what you're saying. I like what you're saying. I believe what you're saying. But the connection is with Tasso, right?
Yeah, but and you know, the more Casey's come down, the greater, like now they look forward to her coming down to do a seminar. You know, the connection's gotten greater with her, but they know that I'm the vehicle that's tied to her kind of thing. So it's real interesting. I guess I got to run through some of it again over and listen to the recording again and try and jot out and just, cause it was really interesting to me. Because the difference in what we had response-wise at Tammy's to what we had here is an amazing difference. I mean, I can tell you that when Casey comes, we do $8,000 more a month in our overall business, personal training and everything.
Well, then tie her up and keep her there.
Yeah.
That's a good investment. All it's just going to be some rope. That's it. All right, I want to mention to you guys, you know, a lot of what I share with you, I know you believe. I know you believe. But how deeply do you believe it? And are you willing to repeat it? And that's why when, you know, you meet a friend of mine like Dr. Blyweiss, you believe it even at a higher level because now there's somebody else of a higher authority speaking about this stuff. I'm going to encourage you to read a book that I just read twice. Altered Genes, Twisted Truth. Altered Genes, Twisted Truth by Stephen Drucker. It tells about GMOs and our government in a way that doesn't come off as some maniac yelling about conspiracy theory, but is purely factual. And it's all the stuff that I'm sharing with people, but I think for you guys, it's going to help with the I believe what you're saying part. I know you hear what I'm saying. I know you like what I'm saying. But I think some of you still kind of have a little bit of resistance based on the beliefs in your head. All the time I hear people go, well, if GMOs were bad, the government wouldn't let us eat them. Well, GMOs are good because they help starving countries get food to their children. I hear this all the time. And I mean, I hear it on airplanes. I hear it at airports. I hear it in hotel lobbies. I mean, I hear it everywhere. And I think this is just a really good book for you guys to read. It's a thick book. It gets a little scientific. But it just nails it. Altered Genes, Twisted Truth. I'm also going to send you the link to the Navaka session that I did with the chiropractors. I think you'll find that valuable. Any other thoughts, comments, questions about anything at all? Hey, I'll tell you one more interesting thing. Just a study that I was really fascinated by. They call it the Oedipus study, referring to a sibling and the parent of the opposite sex. So there were 8-year-old girls and their dads, and they played darts against each other, and the winner got some prize. And there was a painting behind the dartboard or beside the dartboard that had a subliminal message in there. So the first time it said, "Dads always win." The second time it said, "It's okay to beat your dad." Just a really cool study about the subliminal messaging, because when you look at the outcomes, radically different in terms of how the kids did. So they don't do it consciously. They don't go, "I'm going to miss." But there's something to this whole subconscious thing. And that's why so much of what we've learned and mastered about physiology, and it's not what you say, but it's how you say it. You know, all of this is really validated. And when you really start to apply it, you just find that everybody says yes. I think that one of the things that's happened to me is when the reason I love speaking to medical groups now, and I shared this with Tasso earlier, is because the doctors that I speak to are the same in my field of vision as the personal trainers were 25 years ago. Now you'd say, "Oh, how could that be? You know, these are doctors." Well, I think my vision has escalated, but I see the same barrier, and that barrier is fear. And I realize that when you want to get an individual to make a change, you've got to make the pain of them not making the change so present that they feel they must. And that's how I would speak to personal trainers 25 years ago when they told me it's illegal to speak about nutrition. We have to do free consultations. We have to sell packages. I want them to understand you're going to go broke. If you keep going the way you're going, you're not going to have a career. Now, I didn't say it in those words, but that's what I needed them to walk away with. And now the doctors that I speak to, they're starting to understand that if they follow the conventional paradigm that is laid out by the insurance model, they're not going to be able to pay the bills. And I'm serious. So if you can recognize these things, it doesn't matter who you're talking to. It's a matter of controlling that revolving door and getting the bad beliefs out and sending the good beliefs in. And if you really start to understand the impact of what I'm trying to share today, I think all of you are just going to realize you have greater power than you ever realized in the change we could bring about in ourselves and in others. So until we speak again, be better, everybody. Bye-bye.